Today, in part five, entitled Shot Down, we come to a very dramatic turn of events.
Needless to say, there were times for relaxation between trips. On one occasion, Ted, the skipper, Jim and I decided to visit our American allies at an aerodrome about 10 miles away. Incidentally, bikes were the regular form of transport. Very few had cars. Although we were in uniform, we expected we might have a bit of a problem getting permission to enter. But not a bit of it. We were welcomed with open arms and asked what we would like to see. We opted for the flight office so we could get an idea of how they did things. Then, having done that, we asked whether it would be possible to see a B-17 Flying Fortress. To our amazement, we were told, even better, we've got a training detail going up shortly. Would you like to come along? So we did. It was a practice bombing run on a target in Essex. After the crew completed this, Ted was asked by their skipper whether he'd like to sit astride him and try the controls. So he did. Meanwhile, Jim and I went down in the bombardier's compartment, being shown their marvellous new bomb sight, which enabled him to take over control of the aircraft on the bombing run. He was just showing us the button that enabled him to do so when the aircraft went into a steep dive that scared the life out of the bombardier. What had happened was that upstairs, Ted had asked if he could try a few gentle manoeuvres. He mentioned a barrel corkscrew, to which the Yank said, "Anything you can do, we can do." So Ted put the aircraft into a fairly gentle one, but which put the wind up and all the crew, and the bombardier thought he'd actually press the button to cause this. Incidentally, when they did their practice bombing runs, we weren't at all impressed with the results. Afterwards, we were invited to a very good meal. They seemed to have far better range of food than we poor ration folks. This was one of the things that caused friction between us and them. They earned 3 or 4 times what we earned, had smarter uniforms, access to things like chocolate and nylon stockings, so it was not surprising that they were more popular with English girls than we were. This often led to unruly behaviour in places like Cambridge, where half the pubs were out of bounds to Yanks and the other half to us.
To get back to the flying, I mentioned earlier the pathfinders who marked the target for us. They were usually Mosquitoes, a remarkable little twin-engine aircraft whose fuselage and wings were made of balsa wood, making them very light and therefore capable of a speed faster than most fighters. They had a very sophisticated navigation system that enabled them to find the target accurately. They had two sorts of markers: low-level ones, the most accurate, but also high-level ones to use if there was cloud cover. On the occasion of the bigger raids, there were one or more master bombers who would circle around the target at fairly low levels and broadcast to the rest of us precise directions as to where to drop our bombs. These were indeed very brave fellows. We were only too happy to get out of the target area as soon as possible, as while there, you were subject to not only flak and fighter attack, the very real chance of collision, and even being bombed by aircraft above you. In fact, collision was always a fear, particularly when flying in cloud, as with anything of up to 200 or 300 aircraft in a stream covering 10 minutes or so, and with no lights, of course, anything could happen, and particularly when turning away from the target. We had one occasion when we were flying just above cloud, when a Halifax suddenly appeared from the cloud no more than 50 yards or so from us. There was one more trip that was memorable, mostly for what happened many years later. This was a raid on Valken Island off the Dutch coast. We were to bomb some particularly significant German fortifications there. Our squadron was chosen to lead the raid, a daylight one, and as we were now the senior crew, it was our privilege to lead. We met little opposition, and for us it was a pretty uneventful run. About 40 years later, I had a letter from a Dutchman who was there at the time of this raid. He wanted to write a book called We Never Blamed the Crews, in which he would give both sides of the story and why the raid was absolutely essential, given their situation at the time. even though many locals were killed or injured. I was able to give him what he wanted, plus a photograph of the crew, and I eventually bought a copy of the book, which I still have.
On average, we flew about 3 missions a week, so we did have a short time to relax in between. During this time, our relationship with Betty, the teacher, got more passionate on her part, although I never got terribly serious. In any case, I'd seen Doreen on my leaves and we were getting closer. The same with Kathy, the Batwoman. I took her out a few times, but there again, she seemed to want more than I could give her. Apart from these, we seemed to divide our time between the mess and pubs in Cambridge and Newmarket, mostly in the latter, as it was our nearest town. We used to get up to some pretty wild things at times. The normal length of a tour of operations was 30 sorties, but because we'd done a few easy ones, our tour was extended to 33. We'd actually done 32 when the events of the next part of my story begin. The evening of October the 18th, 1944, was quite a memorable occasion in our squadron's history, for we're having a real slap-up farewell party for our CO, who was leaving us in a few days' time. It can fairly be said that a good time was had by all, especially by our crew, who, having done 30 trips and expecting to finish our tour any time now, felt in a good mood for a celebration. An additional reason in my case was the advent of my coming of age in 3 days' time. Little did we think at the time that this would be our last evening in Blighty for many a long month. The following morning, we all woke up with slight hangovers and consequently were not over pleased to find ourselves on the battle order for that night. However, this will be one more trip nearer the end, we thought, as we went into the briefing room and spoke jokingly of starting our second tour, etc. So the target was Stuttgart. An old friend of ours, was it? Oh well, it won't be as bad as when we last went there, before France was liberated. This was probably true until we reached the target, which we did bang on time. But no sooner had Jim announced bombs gone than there was a terrible crash, a lurch of the kite, and flames were pouring out of the port engines. I immediately attached my parachute, surprisingly enough with no feeling of fear or panic, and the next thing I heard was a skipper on the intercom ordering us to abandon aircraft, upon which I took my turn behind Jim and Harry in jumping through the front hatch.
Many times in the past I'd wondered how I would react to such a moment as this, but here I was calmly jumping into space over an inferno of flames and flashes of bursting guns, as if I was getting out of bed in the morning. I must have instinctively pulled the ripcord, for I cannot recall having done so, and the next thing I knew I was floating in space with a huge canopy over me. The first thing that struck me was the difference in noise. Instead of the incessant roar of engines, it was now deadly quiet, except for the continual crack of bursting shells all around and the rumble of guns and exploding bombs from the ground. I did not seem to be moving at all, except when flak shells burst perilously close and I was swayed from side to side by the blast therefrom. The air was very damp and cold and smelled strongly of cordite, reminding me of the smell of persisting on the nights of many a November the 5th in pre-war days. Up above I could hear the drone of our planes getting fainter and fainter, and looking down I could see 3 other parachutes directly beneath me, disappearing into a cloud, where I lost sight of them.
I must have been in the air for about 20 minutes altogether, but it seemed to me an eternity. Many were the thoughts that passed through my mind as I floated down, gradually being blown away from the target area by a fairly strong northwesterly wind, much to my relief. Foremost among my thoughts was the fact that my 21st birthday celebrations, which Mum was working so hard to try and make successful, would have to be called off. What a terrible blow it would have been to Mum to get the news that I was missing a day before her son's 21st, and a few days before I was due to come home on leave. However, by this time I was falling through cloud layers, which made me very wet and bitterly cold, and also swung me about, up and down, to and fro, until I was nearly sick. At last I passed through the last bit of cloud, and beneath me I could see nothing but blackness. I now had to brace myself, for I might hit the ground at any time. And what should I hit? Would it be in a town, in the open country, in woods, in water? I could see a slightly lighter vein running along beneath me, probably a river. I pulled the shrouds so as to try to avoid this, and the next thing I knew, I felt myself surrounded by branches of a tree. I clung to the branches as I felt myself slipping down, and I attempted to find the trunk, but could not. So when I had reached the lowest branch, imagining that there couldn't be far to drop, released my chute and dropped. Little did I think that I had landed in a tree whose lowest branch was about 40 feet off the deck. For that it was, and when I landed, I thought I had broken my back.
Well, I was now on German soil and had to keep my wits about me if I was going to escape detection. It was pitch dark and raining, and apart from the noise of the raid going on a few miles away, the only thing I could hear was the pitter-pattering of the rain among the trees. After listening for some time to make sure my descent had not been heard, and also to ascertain whether any other of our boys were around, I decided it was useless to start evading that night, and the only thing I could try and do was to get some sleep. So, making my May West a pillow and my chute a sleeping bag, I attempted to get to sleep, just as the last of our boys droned overhead, back to dear old Blighty, and before long the countryside re-echoed with the sound of the all clear. Little did they know, as I did, that in another 3 to 4 hours they would receive another visit from Butch Harris's boys. My sleep that night was, needless to say, very fitful, and interrupted by the second great raid on Stuttgart in 4 hours. Boy, it sounded good to hear those boys droning over and the bombs pouring down. I'd often wondered what 4,000-pounders sounded like when they exploded. Well, I had my answer that night. The gunfire was pretty terrific, and several times I heard bits of shrapnel whistling down near me. Following the all clear, I did manage to get a little sleep, in between trying to keep myself dry.